Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents River of Blood by William W. Johnstone and J. A. Johnstone. Narrated by Cody Roberts. Chapter 1. Breckinridge Wallace ran for his life. Behind him, an enormous bear lumbered after him, moving with shocking speed despite its great size. The same could be said of Breckinridge, who stood several inches over 6 feet, making him close to a head taller than most men, and whose shoulders seemed to be as wide as an axe handle. Bundles of corded muscle in his arms and shoulders stretched the buckskin shirt he wore. He was a giant among men, and he sometimes joked that he was still young and hadn't gotten his full growth yet. He wouldn't get much older if he wasn't able to outrun that damn bear, he thought as he raced across a flower-dotted mountain meadow toward a line of trees. The scenery surrounding him was beautiful, and he would have been able to appreciate it better if he hadn't been running for his life. Snow-capped mountain peaks loomed majestically over the lush meadows on the lower slopes. Off to Breckinridge's right, a fast-flowing stream bubbled down from the heights, seeming to laugh and sing as it raced over its rocky bed. Towering pines reached for the deep blue sky. Those pines offered Breckinridge his only hope of escape. If he had to keep running, sooner or later, the bear was going to catch him. He had to climb if he wanted to live. Mentally, he cursed his foolishness. Even though he hadn't been in the Rocky Mountains for very long, common sense alone should have told him that it was a bad idea to have anything to do with a bear cub. Having grown up in the Smoky Mountains back in Tennessee, he knew good and well that messing with any animal offspring was dangerous. The fuzzy little thing had been so doggone adorable, though, as it rolled around in the wildflowers, and Breckinridge hadn't hurt it. All he'd done was pick it up. Then the mama bear had exploded out of some nearby brush with an ear-shattering roar, and the race was on. Breckinridge had spied some trees in the distance, so he dropped the cub and lit out toward them. Bears could climb trees, of course. But a man could climb higher, or at least, so Breckinridge hoped. All he had to do was stay out of reach of that maternal rage until the mama bear got tired or distracted and moved on. Assuming, of course, that he was able to make it to the trees before she overhauled him. His long, bright red hair flew out behind him as he ran. Some Indians he'd run into in the past had dubbed him Flame Hair because of it. He was running so fast now that it seemed like his hair might actually catch on fire because of his speed. Breckinridge knew that was a pretty fanciful notion, but it crossed his mind anyway. He looked over his shoulder, saw that the bear had gained on him, and tried to move even faster. That wasn't possible, though. His long legs were already flashing back and forth as swiftly as they could. He covered ground in great leaps and bounds. His salvation, in the form of those pine trees, drew ever nearer. But so did the bear. Breckinridge was still carrying his long-barreled 50-caliber flintlock rifle. He tossed it aside to lighten his load. A few steps later, he pulled the pair of flintlock pistols from behind his belt and threw them aside as well. Breck hated to discard his weapons, but they were only slowing him down. He could always pick them up later, if he survived. For a second, when the mama bear charged him, he had thought about shooting her. He'd abandoned that idea pretty quickly for a couple of reasons. One, he wasn't sure he could bring down the bear with a single rifle shot, and he didn't figure the pistols would do much damage to her. And two, he didn't want to deprive that cub of its mother. The little varmint might not survive without somebody looking after it, and it wasn't the cub's fault that Breckinridge was such an impulsive galoot. The bear was so close behind him now that the earth seemed to shake under him every time its ponderous paws slapped the ground. He thought he felt the creature's hot breath searing the back of his neck, but that was probably just his imagination. If the bear was really that close, it would have already laid him open with a swipe of the razor-tipped claws on its paw. He was only a few yards away from the closest tree now. He saw a likely branch about 8 feet from the ground, and barely slowed down as he leaped for it. His hand slapped the rough bark and closed around it with a desperate grip. His weight and momentum swung his body forward. With the athletic grace he had been blessed with since childhood, Breckenridge kicked his legs upward, continuing the swing and twisting in midair so that he was able to hook a knee over the branch as well. Below him, the bear roared and reared up on her hind legs to swat at him. Breckenridge felt the claws rake through his hair. That was how close he came to having his head stove in like a dropped melon. He reached up, grabbed a higher branch, and the powerful muscles in his arms and shoulders bunched and swelled even more as he pulled himself higher in the tree. The pine's sharp needles jabbed at his face, but he ignored the discomfort. It would be a lot more painful to fall into that bear's not-so-tender embrace. He got a booted foot on another branch and pushed himself up. Below, the bear stopped trying to hit him and started climbing instead. The branches were close together, though, and the beast had trouble forcing herself through the dense growth. Breckenridge, even with his broad shoulders, was able to twist and writhe as he climbed, making his ascent easier. The branches got thinner the higher he went, and so did the trunk. Breckenridge felt the tree start to sway a little from the combined weight of him and the bear. He started to worry that the tree would lean over so far the bear would be able to get at him easier. For a second, he dropped his right hand to his waist and closed it around the bone handle of the hunting knife with its long, heavy blade. If he had to, he would draw the knife and try to fight off the bear with it, cold steel against fang and claw. He still didn't want to hurt the bear, but he would defend himself if it became necessary. His instincts wouldn't let him do anything else. He climbed until he was a good 30 or 40 feet off the ground. The view from up here was spectacular, he thought briefly, but he was more interested in what was directly below him by about 15 feet. The bear had stopped climbing, perhaps sensing that the trunk was getting too thin to support her. With her claws dug into the rough bark, she roared in anger and frustration and shook the tree. Breckenridge had moved in closer to the trunk himself, so he was able to throw his arms around it and hang on for dear life as the pine tree rocked back and forth. That went on for several minutes, long enough that Breckenridge felt himself getting a little sick to his stomach. Finally, though, the bear stopped shaking the tree, making grumbling, disgusted sounds almost like a human. The huge, shaggy beast began climbing back down. Breckenridge clung to the trunk and tried to catch his breath. His pulse was pounding inside his head like a blacksmith's hammer beating out a horseshoe on a forge. The bear dropped the last few feet to the ground, then started pacing around the tree. From time to time, she looked up and bellowed at Breckenridge. He wondered just how stubborn she was going to be about this. She wasn't showing any signs of wandering off like he'd hoped, that was for sure. So for the time being, he was stuck up here. And as it did every time he was trapped in enforced idleness, his mind began to wander. His thoughts went back to the way he had come to the Rocky Mountains in the first place. Chapter 2. Trouble had a way of finding Breckenridge Wallace. It wasn't that Breck ever went out looking for it. Well, maybe he did every now and then. But for the most part, he was a peaceable young man. True, he had a thirst for adventure, for new places and new experiences. That fiddle-footed nature surely would have led to him leaving his family's farm near the town of Knoxville, Tennessee, sooner or later. He knew his pa and his four older brothers could take care of the place just fine without his help. It wasn't like he'd ever been that diligent about carrying out his chores anyway. As far back as he could remember, every chance he'd gotten, he would run off to the woods, to hunt and explore and just be out in the world, enjoying it. Now and again, those adventures had landed him in trouble, of course. Like the time those four Chickasaw renegades had tried to kill him. That had gained him a bitter enemy in the person of the scarred, vengeful warrior called Tall Tree. Tall Tree was dead now, but Breckinridge Wallace had other enemies in the world, through no real fault of his own. Take Richard Aylesworth, the son of a wealthy merchant in Knoxville who had been Breckinridge's main rival for the affections of the beautiful Maureen Grantham. Of course, as it turned out, the rivalry hadn't really amounted to much. Maureen had chosen Aylesworth over Breck without really hesitating. Aylesworth was handsome and rich after all, a polished and sophisticated gentleman, instead of a big, red-headed galoot with none of the rough edges knocked off. To be fair, though, Maureen hadn't married Aylesworth until after Breckinridge was gone from the area, having taken off on the run from a dubious murder charge that, when you came right down to it, was Richard Aylesworth's fault. Fleeing the law, away from home for the first time in his life, Breckinridge had fallen in with assorted shady characters, found himself in and out of danger, lost everything he had, fought river pirates and Indians, shot a man in St. Louis who had it coming, scouted for the army, and made a good friend, Lieutenant John Francis Mallory, with whom Breck had made a pact to go west to the Rockies, known by some as the Shining Mountains, and become fur trappers. Mallory hadn't lived to see that day arrive, but to honor his friend's memory, Breckinridge had followed through on the plan they had made. After a disastrous trip home, back to Tennessee, Breck had hired on with a party of trappers headed up the Missouri River. That just led to more trouble, of course, since it had a way of finding Breckinridge. Trust had been betrayed, lives had been lost, old scores had been settled, and four survivors from the party had continued on west. In addition to Breckinridge, the other men were Morgan Baxter, Roscoe Akins, and Amos Fulbright. Baxter was the son of the man who'd financed the expedition, and as the sons of rich men usually were, at least in Breck's experience, he was a real jackass starting out. The hardships and tragedies they had suffered along the way had forced Morgan to grow up a mite, though, and Breck had come to like him. Akins and Fulbright were typical trappers, rough, stolid men without much education or imagination, but you could count on them when the chips were down, and out here, that was perhaps the most valuable quality of all. After the violence that had shrunk the group to its current level, the four men had pushed on upriver, into the heart of the Rockies, until they found this long valley with its lush meadows and numerous streams. This was prime beaver country, Breckinridge thought, although from everything he had heard back in St. Louis, the beaver weren't as plentiful anywhere as they had once been. Trappers had been coming out here for more than 20 years, and their efforts had shrunk the beaver population. Breckinridge and his companions meant to give the business a try anyway, so they had set up camp and gone about running trap lines along the creeks in the area. Every day they split up to check those traps, and that was what Breck had been doing when he spotted something that made him curious, and wandered away from the creek to look at the little bear cub. And that was how he'd come to find himself up a tree, with a couple of 1,000 pounds of furry rage pacing around below him, waiting to tear him apart. The mama bear was nothing if not stubborn. She stalked around and around the tree for what seemed like hours, while Breckinridge waited up in the branches. He was starting to get hot and thirsty, but he didn't have any water with him. He tried not to think about it, but that didn't always work. Morgan's, Aiken's, and Fulbright were elsewhere in the valley, probably within a few miles. If he'd been able to fire a shot, they might have heard it and responded to see what was wrong. But his rifle and pistols were lying out there in the meadow. The guns might as well have been back in St. Louis, for all the good they could do him right now. He had his powder horn, though, along with steel and flint. Maybe he could start a signal fire and burn the tree down around him. Yeah, that was a fine idea, Breckenridge told himself caustically. He needed to do a better job of thinking things through. If he'd done that in the first place, he would have stayed far away from that bear cub and wouldn't be in this fix now. No, he was just going to have to be patient. There wasn't any other way around it. Once he had come to that conclusion, he decided that he might as well put the time to good use. He used the rawhide strap from his powder horn to tie his left wrist to a sturdy branch, then wrapped his legs around a lower branch, leaned against the tree trunk, and went to sleep. Breckenridge had no idea how long he sat there dozing, but after a while he heard shouts that jolted him out of his slumber. He lifted his head and shook it to clear out the cobwebs of sleep. He heard a chuffing and growling below him, and knew the bear was still maintaining her vigil.
"Breckenridge! Breck! Where in blazes are you?"
"Hey, Breck! You around here?"
Breckenridge recognized the voices of Morgan Baxter and Roscoe Aikens. A moment later, Amos Fulbright joined in, calling,
"Hey there, Breck Wallace."
The three voices came from slightly different directions. Breckenridge figured they had returned to camp from checking the other trap lines. Then, when he didn't show up too, they had come to look for him. They knew which direction he had gone when he left that morning, so it wasn't difficult to follow his trail. He untied his wrist from the branch and looped the powder horn strap around his neck again. Standing up carefully, he balanced on a branch and parted some of the other growth to look out across the valley. His keen eyes spotted a man wearing a buckskin jacket and a broad-brimmed hat of brown felt about a quarter of a mile away. That was Morgan Baxter, Breckenridge thought. He held on to the tree with one hand and cupped the other to his mouth as he shouted,
"Morgan! Hey, Morgan! Over here in the trees!"
Morgan's head lifted, telling Breckenridge that he'd heard the shout. He turned and called to the other two men, then started loping toward the trees, carrying his rifle.
"Morgan, don't get too close," Breckenridge yelled. "There's a bear."
He kept calling the warning until Morgan slowed down and waved to the others to be careful as well. Morgan came to a stop about 100 yards away and cupped his hands to shout,
"Breck, where are you?"
The bear's head swung toward him. Folks said the bears couldn't see very well, but they had excellent senses of hearing and smell, and relied on them to locate enemies. Breckenridge didn't know for a fact that any of that was true, but this bear heard Morgan, no doubt about that.
"Stay back," Breckenridge called again. "Don't come any closer."
"Good Lord!"
The exclamation came from Fulbright.
"That grizz has run him up a tree. Breck, are you all right?"
Aikens called. The bear's head swung back and forth as she tried to figure out where all the humans were. The way the voices were coming from different directions seemed to have confused her. That gave Breckenridge an idea.
"Boys, keep yelling. Whoop it up."
The three trappers followed Breckenridge's suggestion. They whooped and hollered and created a racket that echoed back from the hills at the edge of the valley. At the foot of the tree, the bear lurched one way and then another, growling and occasionally bellowing in frustration. She wasn't sure which way to turn because she had no way of knowing which of the humans represented the greatest threat to her cub. Her exasperation led her to rise up on two legs, paw viciously at the air, and let loose with a tremendous roar. Then, muttering almost like a person again, she dropped back to all fours and started toward the creek. Breckenridge figured she had decided her best course of action would be to return to her cub and forget all about these crazy two-legged critters. Morgan, Akins, and Fulbright waited until the bear was several hundred yards away before they approached the tree Breckenridge had climbed. Breck was still up there in the branches, gazing off into the distance.
"You can come down now,"
Morgan called to him. "The bear's gone."
"Where are you stuck?" Fulbright asked with a grin on his whiskery face.
"No, I ain't stuck,"
Breckenridge replied with a little annoyance of his own.
"I just noticed something. Looks like somebody else heard all the hollering that was going on."
He lifted a long, muscular arm and pointed at a thin, broken column of smoke rising in the distance. Smoke signals. Indians were talking to each other over yonder, and Breckenridge had a pretty good idea what they were talking about. Chapter 3. Since the battle that had left most of the party dead on the way out here, Breckenridge and the other three survivors hadn't had any more trouble with the Indians. They had run into a few Crow, but the word had spread through the tribe that the man they called Flamehair was considered a friend. This wasn't really Crow country, though. From what Breckenridge had heard, the most common tribe around here was the Blackfoot, and they were ornery varmints who didn't consider anybody a friend except themselves, neither red nor white. The smart thing for the four trappers to do would have been to stay together all the time, as a war party was a lot less likely to attack a group of four well-armed men than they were a lone trapper. But doing that meant it would take them four times as long to gather the same number of pelts, and that was just plumb wasteful. Besides, they hadn't seen any Indian sign in this valley, so it had seemed safe enough for them to split up whenever they ran their lines. Until now. Luckily, the four of them were together at the moment, and they needed to stay that way. Breckenridge shinnied most of the way down the tree and then dropped to the ground. His hands were sticky from pine sap, so he started wiping them on his buckskin trousers.
"Is that smoke what I think it is?"
Morgan Baxter asked worriedly.
"I reckon it must be," Breckenridge replied. "I don't know for sure. I haven't ever seen smoke signals myself. But I can't figure what else it could be."
Akins said. "There's smoke signals, all right. I was out here a couple years ago, and the bunch I was with saw smoke like that for a couple of days before a bunch of Arikara jumped us. Did good to get out with our hair, we did. Not that you had a whole hell of a lot to lose," Fulbright said, referring to the thin blonde growth on Akin's skull.
"This is no time for joking," Morgan said. "We were told this was Blackfoot territory, so if anybody's responsible for those smoke signals, it's probably them. They're hostile to whites."
"And to everybody else," Breckenridge added. "We'd best get back to camp. If we're in for a fight, we want to have as much powder and shot at hand as we can."
What he said made sense. He trotted out into the meadow to pick up the rifle and pistols he had thrown aside when the bear was chasing him. And then all four of them moved quickly up the valley toward their campsite. A bluff topped with trees and rocks reared up next to one of the creeks. And that was where they had made camp when they reached the valley a couple of weeks earlier. The location was handy to water, and the trees and rocks would provide cover if they needed it. The height advantage, although it wasn't dramatic, wouldn't hurt anything either. The four men reached the stream on which their camp was located and followed it, trotting along the grassy banks. The creek twisted around a bend up ahead, dropped down a short, rocky waterfall, and then traced a fairly straight, level course across a mile-wide meadow to the camp. As the trappers entered the little cut at the top of the waterfall, Breckenridge spotted something and threw out an arm to stop the others.
"We're too late," he said. "They're already over there."
"How can you see that?" Akins asked sourly. "The camp's a mile away."
"I've got good eyes,"
Breckenridge said simply. It was true. He had been blessed with exceptional sight, hearing, and smell. He figured that was the good Lord's way of outfitting him for the perilous existence in the wilderness he now knew he was meant for. He had never felt as much at home as he did out here in the high country.
"Can you tell how many of them there are?" Morgan asked.
"Not for sure. At least half a dozen, I'd say. They're moving around, though, so it's hard to get an exact count."
"What are they doing?"
Fulbright said.
"Just rummaging around right now."
"They're going to steal our supplies," Morgan said. His voice was bleak. "The damned thieves! They'll probably take all our pelts, too."
They had several dozen pelts already dried and rolled up for transport, and four or five more scraped, stretched out, and pegged down to dry. Not enough to make or break anybody, but still worth a significant amount of money. Enough that Breckenridge didn't want to lose it. His eyes narrowed in thought. After a moment, he said,
"Here's what we're going to do. You three fellas stay out of sight, circle off to the west, and then come at the camp from that direction. There's a considerable amount of trees and brush over there, so maybe you can get fairly close without those varmints noticing you, especially since they'll be busy looking at something else."
"What are they going to be looking at?"
Morgan asked suspiciously.
"Me," Breckenridge said. "I figured I'd walk across that meadow beside the creek, big as life and twice as ugly, so they'll watch me and not pay any attention to you boys."
"That's crazy," Morgan argued. "As soon as you get close enough, they'll just shoot you."
"Maybe not. From everything I know about Injuns, they're a curious lot. They'll want to know why a lone white man is walking in like that, bold as brass. They may think I don't know they're there, in which case they'll lay low and let me get closer before they make themselves known. Anyway, I'm going to keep them occupied so you fellas can sneak up on them."
"White men sneaking up on Indians," Akins muttered. "It's supposed to be the other way around, ain't it?"
"Most of the time," Breckenridge admitted. "But if it's good enough for them, I reckon it's good enough for us."
Morgan rubbed his chin and frowned in thought. After a moment, he nodded slowly and said,
"It might work. What happens if we're able to get up close?"
"Wait until they come out in the open to jump me, and then you can cut loose at 'em," Breckenridge said. "That'll take 'em by surprise and give me a chance to run in and start wailing away on 'em."
"This may be pretty unlikely, but what if they're friendly?"
"Well, then we won't kill 'em, of course. There's always a chance they ain't Blackfeet. Might be Shoshone or some such. In which case, we might even be able to do some trading with 'em."
Fulbright scratched at his thick black beard, grimaced, and asked,
"How will we know whether or not they're friendly?"
"You'll be able to tell," Breckenridge said confidently. "If they ain't, there's a good chance they'll be doing their damnedest to kill me."
Chapter 4 Breckenridge waited until the other three men had waded across the creek, moved down the slope, and headed off to the west, crouching and using every bit of cover they could find as they trotted along. Once they were out of sight, he canted his rifle jauntily over his shoulder and marched down the hill in plain sight. He followed the creek across the meadow, strolling along as if he didn't have a care in the world. He even whistled a little tune, although he was still too far away from the camp for the Indians to hear him. When he was a little more than halfway across the meadow, he noticed that the interlopers had stopped moving around. He looked close but couldn't see them anymore. That lack of activity convinced him that the Indians had noticed his approach. Either they had...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?